chapter, back in chapter 6, we were introduced to the new dilemma, the new problem facing the Israelites, which were, as noted in the first 10 verses, the Midianites, the Amalekites, and then the people of the east, and so that they were coming in and raiding the crops and livestock of the children of Israel, that the Israelites cried out, God sent them a prophet, and then we're introduced to Gideon, who, as you recall, when we were introduced to him, he was threshing wheat in a wine press, not on a threshing floor, for fear of these Midianites, of these enemies of the Israelites that had invaded the land. He starts out as a very timid, fearful individual, and God patiently helps to build his faith, and he's called to tear down the altar of Baal that his father was either in charge of or responsible for building, which he does. His own people turn against him, and they want to put him to death, but his life is spared. And then almost immediately, he starts calling up an army from the tribes of Manasseh, according to verse 35 in chapter 6, Asher, Zebulun, Naphtali. I didn't mention it last week, but it's going to come into play in our class this week that he didn't ask the tribe of Ephraim, and they're going to complain about that at the beginning of chapter 8. We'll get to that in just a moment. Then at the end of chapter 6 is where Gideon asked for two signs, the two signs of the fleece, which again God graciously granted to him. So now picking up in chapter 7, we're going to set the scene, maybe one of the most well-known texts in the Old Testament, where Gideon's initial forces of about 32,000 men is whittled way down to just 300 men. And initially they're located by the spring of Herod, which we note from verse 1 of chapter 7. And that Hebrew word for Herod actually shares the same root as the Hebrew word for trembling, which will come into play in just a moment. So here, Gideon and his 32,000 men force are camped by about 6 miles from this force, from the Midianites. So just to put it into perspective here, the spring of Herod is here. This is the Jezreel Valley, which we've talked about several times so far. And likely the Midianites were over here, the force that was probably over 100,000, and then Gideon's force starts off here. And so the distance there to there is about 6 miles, just to illustrate what it might have looked like back then. They're described, though, like locusts in abundance, and their camels were without number, as the sand that is on the seashore. So imagine being Gideon in charge of this force. You're starting out with 32,000 fighters, but you're still looking out at a force of over 100,000 fighters. That's pretty intimidating, pretty daunting odds. However, God tells Gideon, the people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, my own hand has saved me. So first, God instructs Gideon to allow anyone who is fearful and trembling to return home. Back in our study in Deuteronomy, or you may just remember this, God allowed for several exceptions for fighting men to not have to engage in battle. Some of those exceptions were if they were betrothed, if they had recently planted a vineyard, and in verse 8 of Deuteronomy chapter 20, when the officers were speaking to the people about going into battle, they would say, is there any man who is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go back to his house, lest he make the heart of his fellows melt like his own. So this was an exception that God had put in place. If anyone's fearful, go ahead and head back home. And so the majority now of Gideon's fighting force, 22,000, leave. And that leaves Gideon with 10,000 men. But God's making very clear from the beginning that the glory for this victory was going to be his. And so even if Gideon thought with 32,000 people, this is daunting odds, now he's down to 10,000, even more daunting. And it's going to make all the more absurd the people's request for Gideon to be their leader, their king, after this endeavor, because according to them, he had supposedly delivered them from the Midianites. Well, what could Gideon have done with 10,000, or even, as we're going to come to find out, 300 men, finally? But just pause for a moment and consider Gideon's faith journey up to this point. God sent an angel to him, assuring him of his ability, called him a mighty man of valor, assuring him his ability to lead the Israelites to defeat the Midianites, and he gave him proofs. He's even going to give him one more in this chapter. And now God is testing Gideon by strictly or severely winnowing his forces. And so while at the end of chapter 6, Gideon tested God with the signs of the fleece, now God is testing Gideon. So God tells Gideon that 10,000 men is still too much. So again, this is a picture of the spring of Herod where the next test is to be performed. So these 10,000 men in God's sight were still too many. So he takes them down to this spring and separates them based on how they drink. 300 men end up lapping the water with their tongues like a dog while all the rest knelt down to drink. If you're like me, you've maybe heard varying interpretations of the different ways that they drank from this pool. And so the text makes clear, God says, just go down to the water. There's going to be a difference in the men you're going to select versus the men you're going to send away. There seems to be a distinction between those who knelt down to drink versus others who more or less prostrated themselves or laid down and drank from the spring like a dog. Some commentators will say, well, then that left Gideon with the 300 most experienced men who were aware of their surroundings, aware of the enemy. Other commentators say, well, this test exposed the 300 cowards. So Gideon had already sent away 22,000 men, that these men were exhibiting fear in the way that they drank the water. Let's just be clear that no reason is given for this test in the text. And so no way is called out as the right way, so it may just be a way of trimming down the number of men rather than a critique of either form of drinking. And so I'll leave it at that. But I would submit for you, think about what God is trying to accomplish here. He's going to achieve a great victory against the Midianites, and he's already sent away 22,000 fearful men. There's still this great force of 10,000 men, and would it make sense, especially based on the kind of battle that they're going to fight, to leave Gideon with 300 of the most experienced fighters? I don't think so. It seems like it would be even more stark if these were truly men who were inexperienced and fearful going into battle, and God is achieving a victory with even those 300 men. So not only was it a small group, very small group, compared to the enemy, but the quality of the soldiers may not have been the best. But again, that's just my speculation. Gideon retains these 300 fighters, and he's told by God, with these 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hands. So the stage is set for this battle to begin. Let's pause here, as is sometimes helpful in our study of the Bible, and just put ourselves in Gideon's shoes at this point. So his forces have just been reduced by 99%. He went from 32,000 men down to 300. And now he faces a horde, an enemy horde, almost 500 times the size of his own. And as you read through this, it's not clear to me, and I'm not sure we know, if the battle plan that Gideon ends up enacting was given to him by God. And so it may be that with these 300 men, Gideon had to think, okay, what now do we need to do with God's help to achieve this victory? And he comes up with the plan we'll talk about in just a minute. So again, this is not a walk in the park for Gideon. It's not a walk in the park for these 300 men. And so when God tells him in verse 10, if you are afraid to go down to the camp, and he's going to give this extra sign. Let's not be too critical of Gideon, because here he is with a fighting force of 300 men, knowing that God has assured him of defeat of this Midianite army, but still not sure exactly how that's going to work out. So not only is Israel outnumbered, but it also has no weaponry save trumpets. That's going to foreshadow the means of their victory, which we'll talk about more in just a minute. So that brings us down through verse 8, but I'll pause here and see if anybody has a question or comment before we go on. Yes, sir.
I've thought about this before. What's special about 300 men? God could have, you know, defeated the army by himself or with one person, with Gideon alone. But it seems to me that God was using a miracle for those 300 men to see his powers, not just Gideon and Gideon's word as he takes it back to the rest of the nation of Israel. It's these 300 men that are also going to go back and tell of the delivery that God gave them.
Yeah, good point.
And no doubt, you know, later in the chapter, they're going to call other Israelites from the tribes of Naphtali, Asher, Manasseh, and they're all going to go after Midian as they're running away. And so no doubt that they would have shared this account with them, and that would have greatly bolstered their faith to, you know, complete the job. Good point. All right, let's move on. Oh, Wyatt, go ahead.
And if you compare 8 verse 10, you'll see that if the numbers given there are the force that they're up against, they're outnumbered 450 times.
Those are not good odds. Yeah.
But then 8 out of every 9 of those are killed in the process.
Right.
And as we'll come to see, it's not that these 300 men went and wiped out 120,000 on their own. They turned against each other, and that was by God's doing. Yeah, good point. All right, let's pick up in verse 9. So I've mentioned this before a couple of times. God is giving this one more opportunity for Gideon to bolster his faith before this big battle. He instructs him to go down against the enemies and defeat them. But knowing that he may be still struggling with fear, God tells Gideon to take his servant, Purah, to the enemy camp, and that he would be strengthened by what he hears. And so out of this force of over 100,000, Gideon happens to come upon this one Midianite soldier who's telling another comrade about his dream, saying, "A cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down so that the tent lay flat." And what does the other soldier conclude? "This is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp." So upon hearing this in verse 15, Gideon worships. Its word here indicates prostrating oneself to the ground in humble obeisance, which is exactly the reaction he should have had. Quick takeaway for us is that you and I can be similarly strengthened by God before doing something tough. We can be strengthened through prayer. We can be strengthened through the scriptures, and we can be strengthened by our fellow church members, our fellow brothers and sisters in Christ. So now, Gideon is ready for battle. He calls up these 300 men to fight against the Midianites, and he instructs them to put torches inside the jars to surround this enemy camp and to blow the trumpets. And what were they to shout? "For the Lord and for Gideon." And if we have time, we'll pick up more on that in our takeaway. So by holding these items in their two hands, they would have had no ability to hold any weapons. So again, put yourself in the shoes of these 300 men. You have a torch in a jar in one hand, and you have a trumpet in the other, or more accurately, a horn in the other. Further proof that this victory is to be God's, not theirs. And as I mentioned previously, it's not clear to me that God had told Gideon, this is exactly what you need to instruct the men to do, as far as surrounding the camp, putting the torches in the jars, and blowing the trumpets. But if that's the case, and Gideon, as a mighty man of valor and a commander of this force, thought of this plan, again, it speaks to how much his faith has grown since the man we first met in the last chapter, who was hiding the threshing of the wheat in the winepress. It's clear now why Gideon is called a mighty man of valor back in the last chapter. So at around midnight, which the text says was the beginning of the middle watch, when they had just set the watch, so they're changing the guard, what would the majority of this 100,000-plus force be doing at midnight? Sleeping, which necessitated the watch. So around midnight, Gideon and his 300 men surround the Midianites. And as instructed, they smash the jars, revealing the torches. They blow the trumpet, and they shout, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." Was anyone holding a sword? No. So they just had a trumpet, and they just had a torch. But can you imagine being one? You know, I think even when you're at home and something startles you awake in the night, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm not in my best way for lack of a better word. If I'm startled awake in the middle of the night, it's not the best Joel you're going to be getting. So imagine this whole army that's startled awake, and each of these individuals, each of these men with the trumpet and the torches, in the mind of the enemy would be representing an entire battalion, for lack of a better word. And so in the enemy's mind, they're surrounded by 300 groups of these enemy, to them, enemy forces. So this would have been actions performed normally by one individual within each unit of men to signal the unit to engage in battle. So then, believing that they're surrounded by the enemy, the text says the Lord sets every man's sword against his comrade, against all the army. Remember, this is a mixed force of Midianites, Amalekites, and men from the east. And so there's confusion and chaos, and they end up doing Gideon's job mostly for him in killing each other. So the army flees, they're routed, and then as I mentioned previously, other soldiers, other Israelite soldiers are called up to chase them away from the battlefield, which occurred here near the area that we've talked about before. So only now, at the end of chapter 7, are the Ephraimites called to help out. And not only do they take control of the Jordan, as they were asked to do, but they also capture two princes of Midian, two guys named Oreb and Zeb. Oreb's name means raven, and Zeb's name means wolf. And as one commentator put it, it's appropriate because these Midianites had been like scavengers and predators to Israel. So they put Oreb and Zeb to death. And again, it's important to note, Ephraim thinks they should have been asked to fight all the way back in chapter 6 and verse 35, and that'll set up the confrontation we'll read about in just a moment at the beginning of chapter 8. With that, we're making good time, and so I'll pause here and see if anybody has a comment or question so far. Alrighty. Moving on now to this next engagement. We'll get to that picture in just a little bit. But before we get to Gideon's next endeavor against the kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, he faces a different kind of conflict now, one that arises from his own countrymen, these Ephraimites. And notice in verse 1, it says, they accused him fiercely because he did not call them up to fight against Midian. So how does Gideon handle this confrontation? Handle it well or not well? Well, I'll ask and answer my own question then. I'd say, I think he handles it well. He answers diplomatically and humbly. He lowers his position and accomplishments in comparison to the Ephraimites. So the phrase in verse 2 is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? So remember, Ephraim are the ones that are accusing him fiercely, and he's from this clan of the Abiezerites. And so the grape harvest was the entire harvest of grapes. And so he's saying the gleaning of grapes, which is to say the leftovers of the grape harvest of Ephraim, are better than the entire grape harvest of my clan. So he's lowering himself in comparison to what the Ephraimites has done. The NET translates it this way: even Ephraim's leftover grapes are better quality than Abiezer's harvest. Think of how he could have responded to this conflict. You know, he's on a roll. He's on a high, having just facilitated this great defeat and rout of God's enemies. And his response here offers us a useful tool in our toolbox of how to respond when folks are upset with us. Proverbs 15 and verse 1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. It's not how he's going to react in the next confrontation, but we'll get to that in just a minute. And if you've read ahead, you know that this isn't the last time that the tribe of Ephraim takes umbrage with what a judge has done. So we'll get to this in a few weeks, but in chapter 12, that's the time of Jephthah. And Jephthah has a conflict with the Ephraimites then too, and it leads to not a peaceful resolution as in this case, but almost, say, quasi-civil war at that point in chapter 12, infighting within the tribes of Israel. So I'll pause there, and before we get into this account, just ask if anybody has a question or comment about what we talked about so far. Alrighty, so picking up now in verse 4, they're continuing in their pursuit of the Midianite kings now, Zebah and Zalmunna. Gideon and his 300 cross the Jordan River, and they ask for sustenance from the men of Succoth, which was an Israelite town. So both Succoth and Penuel were Israelites, and that's important to remember. These are Israelites whom Gideon is asking for these provisions. And notice in verse 5, he says, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after the kings of Midian." So I give that as another, you know, for lack of a better word, feather in Gideon's hat, that he's concerned about his soldiers. He's saying, please help out these men following me. Not so much about himself, but about his soldiers. Do they comply with this request? Do they give Gideon's men the provisions that he asked for? No. Oh, go ahead, Wyatt.
The king's first.
Right, yeah. So literally, in verse 6, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your army? So they didn't want to aid Gideon until they knew that the Midianite force was taken care of, which of course is not the way that they should have responded. But I'll say that Gideon did not respond to that, I don't think, in the way that he should have responded, because he essentially says in verse 7, when the Lord has given these kings into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. Another way of translating that is I will thresh. So remember how he met Gideon when he was threshing wheat in the wine press? Now he's saying, I'm going to thresh your flesh with the thorns and wilderness and with briars. And these are his fellow Israelites. These aren't Midianites that he's talking to. A similar scene unfolds in the next city that he goes to, which is Penuel. And so their path may have looked something like this. So they're heading from battle to maybe where Succoth was. They're denied there. Then they go to Penuel, and a similar scene unfolds here. However, in Penuel, Gideon says, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower, which he ends up doing. We'll talk about that in a moment. So now, picking up in verse 10, the two kings of Midian were at Karkor, which may have been here. You can see it's really far from where the battle took place up here, with what remained of their forces, some 15,000 men, according to verse 10. They felt like they were secure, at least according to verse 11, so they kind of let their guard down, but they weren't, because Gideon and his forces had come to finish the job and take care of the kings of Midian. Take a step back and for just a moment and note that we can definitely see a change in Gideon, right? So when we first met him, he was fearful and had been brought very low by his circumstances. He was a tentative man. Following his victory now, though, he's responding with threats against those who will not assist him. And part of the larger story of Judges that's going on here is a shift in the character of the Judges that we've mentioned before, from doing God's will and giving God the glory for victory, pointing towards God with their words and their actions, to a trend of self-interest and revenge among the later judges. So we have now here the rest of the Midianite forces here in Karkor. So Gideon and his forces attack their army here, throwing them into a panic, and then pursue and capture these two Midianite kings, Zebah and Zalmunna. But did Gideon put them to death right away? No. He took them as trophies to flaunt them to the men of Succoth and to the men of Penuel. So he takes these kings all the way back to Succoth, first of all, and the text says, teaches them a lesson with the method that he had described previously, with the thorns and the briars. And then, in Penuel, not only did he break down the tower as promised, but he also killed the men of the city there. And so again, I do not agree with the Israelites in Succoth and Penuel not helping Gideon and his forces as they should have done. But I also don't agree with the way that Gideon handled the situation. I don't think that it showed the upstanding character that God would have expected from his judge. So after punishing his fellow Israelites, he now returns his attention to the Midianite leaders, which is where we'll pick up in just a moment in verse 18. But I'll pause there and see. Does anybody have any thoughts? Kyle?
The actions that he took against these two towns seem very outlandish. And I would agree from our standpoint, it would definitely be wrong, right? I think what I always do, and this is just me, this is not something that is necessarily right for everyone, but in a situation like this or similar to this, I think if it was something that Gideon had done that was wrong, you would see a rebuke from God. I don't think God would have allowed in this situation Gideon to do these things that he did in these two towns, and there not be some form of rebuke for us to see. And I think because of that, not that it was a great feat or you would consider it a good thing or anything like that, but that in God's eyes, I would be, in my mind, be safe to say that there was, evidently, he was okay with what he was doing. There must have been a reason or a purpose behind him doing that and there being no retribution from God. Because in many cases, we see very similar things happen that you might just look at by themselves out of context and say, well, that's the same thing. But then you see God's rebuke there. And you know by God's rebuke that there was something wrong that was done there. And so I think the absence of it, at least to some extent, signifies the fact that maybe what he did was not wrong. Brutal for sure, yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to say that it wasn't that, but
I appreciate you bringing that up. I also went back and forth with that because, again, Gideon was a judge and responsible for dispensing justice. But I also thought back to chapter 6 when he was instructed to tear down the altar that his family was responsible for building. You know, at that point, and again, I'm not trying to speak where God hasn't spoke, you know, the right punishment for his family even at that point was to be put to death for what they had done in worship to the idol, which didn't happen. And so I agree with you that there is not an explicit condemnation from God for this, but there's also not an explicit condemnation from God when Jephthah puts his daughter to death based on a vow that he makes later on. But we're not going to talk about that yet. I don't want to open that can of worms tonight. And I really don't even want to open it in a month either, to tell you the truth, but we will talk about it. But I appreciate you bringing that up, and you're right. It's not right what they did, and in one sense, it could be viewed as him achieving justice for the way that they had been mistreated before. So thanks for talking about that. Kaylin?
Lot offering up his daughters to be gang raped, that's also not explicitly condemned, but I don't think that we can say, oh, that was the right thing to do.
Sure. You know, for example. Yeah,
but, and then this also, to me, is very reminiscent of David with Nabal, how, you know, Nabal did not help him, and so he wanted to take revenge, you know, and David was a warrior for the Lord, but that wasn't the right course of action, and so that seems like a pretty clear parallel, so I feel pretty comfortable saying that this is not godly behavior.
Good points. I appreciate y'all bringing that out, and I'll just let the rest of y'all think on that. One of the points I made, if you can remember back in October, in our introductory class, is that God's silence, at least as far as the scripture goes, does not necessarily mean commendation or condemnation. So in this case, sometimes we want that commentary to say this or that was wrong as far as from a prophet or from the writer of Judges, but we don't have it. And so we have to use the broader context of the Bible and what other verses say to make judgments the best we can as far as what God's view of it was, but may not always agree on that, so I appreciate the good discussion there. So now Gideon turns his attention in verse 18 to the Midianite leaders, again, whose lives he had preserved all this time so he could flaunt them in front of the leaders of Succoth and of Penuel, and he brings up an event that I don't think, in fact, I know we haven't read about until this point. He asks them, where are the men whom you killed at Tabor? And the NET translates their response in this way: they were like you, each one looked like a king's son. which in that way may be viewed as a little bit of flattery from these two kings of Gideon. We find out that these actually were the brothers of Gideon. And Gideon says, in response to that, let me find it. They were my brothers, in verse 19, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you. And again, not trying to be too hard on Gideon here, but I don't agree with that either, because their fate as the kings of Midian, leaders of Midian, was sealed in the fact that they were enemies of God and all that they had done against the Israelites. Gideon here seems to say, I would have offered you an olive branch or peace had you not put my relatives to death. And I think this, at least in my view, is a glimpse of Gideon's change of attitude here. So Gideon commands his firstborn, a young man called Jether, to kill these leaders, but this poor young boy is unable to out of fear, which again, in this case, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Zeba and Zalmunna challenge Gideon, they taunt him, and they challenge him to kill them himself, which he does, and then takes the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels. So that puts an end to Midian, and in fact, I don't know if I have a comment here or later on, but as far as I know in the biblical text, this is really the last time that the Midianites are a threat against the Israelites. So this defeat of them is complete and total, which is not true of a lot of Israel's enemies. Now we're going to read about another interesting account in Gideon's story. And you see in verse 22, picking up in chapter 8, men of Israel see all this. And again, the whole purpose of God's strategy for the battle and endeavor against the Midianites was for people not to assume the glory for themselves over this victory, but they see Gideon as having achieved this great victory, and they say, rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also, for you have saved us from the hand of Midian, which again was not correct. Gideon responds in a great way. He says, in the ESV, I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you. One commentary said the Hebrew word order in that response might be paraphrased in this way. It is the Lord and no other who shall rule over you. And so again, good job, Gideon, for pointing to the correct source, the correct and rightful leader of Israel, which was not to be himself or his descendants, but to God. But I think I see, and I hope I'm not reading too much into it, conflict within Gideon, especially based on what he goes on to do. And so what he goes on to do is he asks for the earrings from the spoil, and it says they had gold earrings because they were Ishmaelites. So the they there is the Midianites. So the Midianites, some of the Midianites were Ishmaelites, and they had gold earrings, which the Israelites had taken in spoil. Verse 25 says, we will willingly give them. The Ishmaelites were associated with Midian, even all the way back in Genesis chapter 37. You remember that Joseph's brothers sold Joseph into slavery, and it was the Midianite caravan, which was comprised of Ishmaelites, that took him away to Potiphar's house. And last week we talked about Midian being the son of Abraham and Keturah, his wife after Sarah died, but who was the son born to Abraham before Isaac was born? Ishmael, very good. So lots of connections here. And just briefly, it's sad how many people who were distantly related to the Israelites later go on to be their enemies. So they give Gideon 1,700 shekels of gold, which in today's weights is about 41 pounds. And because the price of gold is super high right now, it's about $2.5 million worth of gold in today's value. So with this gold and the other loot, Gideon makes an ephod and puts it in Ophrah. Remember, that was his hometown. Same place where he had torn down the altar to Baal and the Asherah. So briefly, this is a recreation of what the high priest's garments would have looked like. This is the breastplate. And my understanding is that the ephod was the garment itself, or part of the garment. I'm not exactly sure, because there was the ephod, then the breastplate, and other pieces. This was ornate ceremonial garment worn by the high priest. So the garment itself wouldn't, I don't think, have been made out of gold, but out of some of these other opulent textiles that they would have had as loot from their enemies. And so some have concluded then that the ephod is put for the whole, which is to say that Gideon actually constructed an idol here with a garment on it, making it look like or resemble what the high priest would have worn. I don't know exactly what he constructed as far as how it looked. We know what it was made of. And I don't know what his intentions were, because it's really hard for me to believe, as much good as Gideon has done, for him to have reverted back so quickly to idolatry. But regardless of his intentions, what was the result? What was the result of this ephod that Gideon constructed? The text used some pretty strong language about what happened. It became a snare to Gideon and to his family, and it also says that all Israel whored after it there. And the other verse where we've read about that kind of activity, whoring after something, was after an idol. And that was back at the beginning of Judges, when they would revert back to idolatry. They would whore after these idols in the land of Israel. So again, whatever his intentions were, the result was catastrophic. And at the very least, it could be said that Gideon is responsible for facilitating some idol worship here. And at the very worst, he is creating one of his own. So he's going from tearing down an idol to possibly creating one of his very own. So sad turn of events here. And why, as we read through here, some conclude that Gideon had fallen away at this point with his actions as far as, at least in this instance, of the ephod. Let me pause there. We have a few minutes left. I want to hear from y'all what comments or questions you have about the ephod. Josiah?
Hard to believe that he like intended to make an idol, because it said it was a snare to him and his household. Like, it was more of an unintentional consequence.
Yeah. Which is a good lesson for us, because even if we have good intentions of something we do, the result can still be very damaging, and we have to be cognizant of that. Some think that he may have been trying to create an offering of a portion of the plunder to God, or have designed something as an act to facilitate proper inquiry of God, which again I think was part of the ephod's purpose, was inquiring of God under the Old Testament system. But there was only supposed to be one, as far as I'm concerned, or as far as I know from what we read in, in Exodus 28 and 39. So again, a little hairy there, I'm not exactly sure, but the result, we can all agree, was a negative one. Yes, ma'am?
I think it kind of compares, to me, it kind of compares to when the Israelites were in the wilderness and they were being bitten by snakes, what God had sent to them. And they built, God had them put up this pole with a brass snake on it, which later became an object of worship to the Israelites. So they were really prone to go into idolatry.
Yes, very, very good point. And that's a great parallel that you bring up there, so I appreciate you calling that out. So we have, actually, I think we only have like 1 minute left. I thought we were out at 45. So we'll pause here. We'll talk about the last few verses of chapter 8 and then all of chapter 9 in the next class, but I do see how quickly I can speed ahead just to leave y'all with the takeaway for tonight. So lesson for me, and hopefully for you too, is that we can be tempted to think like the Israelites, like what God was trying to prevent, my own hand has saved me. Or we try and loop ourselves in with God and try and reap some of the glory that's rightly due to him. You remember the shout for the Lord and for Gideon, or sword for the Lord and for Gideon. We try and channel some of that glory that should rightly go to God to ourselves, and that's not to be our purpose at all. So let's always remember that God delivered our souls from sin by his grace, not on these meritorious works that we think we've done, how good we've been. And then our lives are meant to glorify God thoroughly and not to seek glory for ourselves. So that when people see our good works, our light shining before them, they'll give glory to God who is in heaven. So that brings us to the end of our time for tonight. Thanks for your attention and for your participation.